This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth, and we are now going to be shifting gears. We are delighted to have back with us economist Max Wolf. And Max Wolf, chief economist at Disruptive Technology Advisors, a market strategy consultant at 55 Capital, a writer in the areas of international finance and macroeconomics, teaches economics at the New School University Graduate Program in International Affairs, and he's also seen on BBC, NPR, Al Jazeera, Bloomberg TV. His work has been on the Wall Street Journal and many other outlets. Max, welcome back.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to join you.
Max, there is so much going on, and I'll have to say I got a little upset just listening to the sister talk about what is going on in the Caribbean region. And I can't even imagine the level of resources that it will really take to rebuild these economies. And meanwhile, here in the United States, the Trump administration pushing this tax reform. And surprisingly, apparently both Republicans and Democrats are in the mix. But we're not hearing a whole heck of a lot about the tax plan. We are hearing, though, that the rich, on the one hand, is supposed to gain from this tax plan, but Trump is also saying to the press that the rich will not be gaining at all with this plan. What do you know, or any analysis you can give us? Break any of this down for us.
Sure. Well, I think we sort of unusually, we know more about the rebuilding from the natural disaster, which isn't much, but more than we know about what the tax plan will look like. And I'll give you three reasons for that. One, various and mutually exclusive attributes have been sort of thrown at this tax plan. So we've been told, hey, here's some basic facts about the tax plan. It will be only relief for lower income people. Then another one, here's some basic facts about this tax plan. It will lower capital gains tax, and it will lower estate taxes, which are absolutely useless to reducing the tax on low-income people. And then we've also been told that it'll be across-the-board tax cut focused on lower-income people. So those three things are each mutually exclusive with each other. And then, you know, not to be too skeptical here, but the truthfulness of past announcements from the White House and some members of Congress also would leave us in a position to be wise to be a little bit skeptical about whether what materializes will be what has been advertised. So we haven't received much information, and we'd have to heavily discount the information we have received. It does look like there'll be a tax cut. It does look like there'll be a meaningful reduction in the corporate income tax in the United States from 35%, which is the sort of de jure, the legal number now, to something probably closer to 25%. Which is, you know, very meaningful reduction, and that will increase the amount of profits that firms can keep as opposed to distribute to the federal government. That will also, of course, have effects on the revenues of the federal government and will probably aggravate planned cuts, which will come to social programs, perhaps, if what we've seen in the budget materializes. So what we do know is that we were already facing some probably generationally large cuts in social programs in the U.S., and those would probably be increased by the tax cuts, whoever gets the tax relief, only because tax cuts always kind of equate to less revenue in the pockets of the federal government to fund all kinds of things. And we saw yesterday the passage of a commitment to increase funding on military and homeland security. So residually, that means all these discretionary programs, including most of the social benefits outside of Social Security, Medicare, and Medicaid, face significant cuts.
Right. And just, I don't have the figures in front of me here, Max, but I know some data came out recently to that was really bad news for my community, for Black people in the United States who remain, you know, at the bottom. Again, you see the kind of racial divide in all of this. And when they're talking about who benefits from the tax plan, you know, increased profits from corporations. Hopefully there will be some relief for people considered, you know, middle class. But we, as you say, we know that the threatened cuts in social programs will even further devastate communities. So I don't know. I really don't see a silver lining in any of this in terms of what's coming out of the Trump administration and what it will mean for people, you know, sitting at their kitchen table, like I know I do, you know, trying to figure out how you're going to pay the bills, eat and pay your rent. Max Wolf.
Yeah, so look, I mean, I think part of the issue here is we could hope that a reduction in corporate taxes, which sometimes happens, although it's hard to predict and it's in no way guaranteed, we could hope that that would translate into a little bit more appetite for hiring folks, and that would be good in terms of employment. Although we've seen the employment headline numbers recover, we haven't seen the labor force participation recover. In other words, the amount of the society, the portion of society that's in the formal labor force has declined. That looks like a structural rise in the informal economy, which is probably dangerous for social equality long-term or even social stability. But we have seen the unemployment rates at least come very far down, you know, well below 5%, which is positive. But we've seen wages be very stuck. So wages are probably the bigger issue right now for a lot of Americans than employment, although that remains a challenge for many. I think the other way to think about it is, even if you're out there and you will receive a tax cut of some kind, the question is, what cut in services will you receive? And will you be left better off as an individual? And what cut in services to your community will occur? And will the community be better off? So even if you do get a tax cut, if you also receive a lot of government services or subsidized goods and services from the federal government, and those are cut, you could easily find yourself worse off. And the reason I bring this up is, we've largely been conditioned to look only at what we pay for our government and not to think about what we get from the government. It's very not in vogue to think about that. But the truth is that whether it's paved roads or airports or national security or the armed services or fire and natural disaster relief or FEMA or the national atmospheric and oceanic groups that are tracking and let us know about these storms to make their devastation less likely to result in loss of life, there's actually a lot that we do get, separate and apart even from Social Security, Medicare, Medicaid, that we do actually get from the federal government. And when we start cutting these things, even if we do get a tax cut, it becomes important on the community level as well as on the individual level to figure out not just what you get back in the extra $130 a month or whatever it works out to be, but if you get $130 a month and you lose fire, police protection, and public health infrastructure, it'd be kind of hard to imagine you'd buy that back with the $130 a month.
Yeah, absolutely. And the other thing is, you mentioned the disasters here. You know, the theoretical basis of people like Paul Ryan, you know, a fan of Ayn Rand and, you know, her philosophy of selfishness, basically, and looking out for number one, also is against what they describe as, quote unquote, big government, right? And one wonders that with Harvey hitting in Houston and then Florida being hit with Irma, if some of the Trump supporters who are opposed to big government, they're some of the first ones lining up to get help from FEMA. So you're right to underscore what people, you know, get from paying taxes. But the other thing, too, though, when you look at, I think it was the defense bill just went through the Senate, $700 billion, more money than what Trump asked for. And then you've got this Graham, I don't remember the other senator that's going in with Graham now on this new health care bill. A lot of people thought that the GOP health care bill was dead. Well, it's not. It's alive and well in the Senate, and it's sounding as though it has a good chance of slipping through. But they want to do the vote without any rating from the Congressional Budget Office. So when one looks at the economy, you also have to look at how else, you know, where else the money is going. If you look at defense, right? And who knows what the cost of this, it's the Graham Cassidy bill. Who knows what the cost of this Graham Cassidy bill is going to be? And all of that impacts all of us.
Sure. So we've seen in the past, it's a bit unusual that a Republican president with a Republican House and a Republican Senate has been largely unable to pass the marquee legislation. So that wouldn't have been anyone's baseline assumption. It's a bit counterintuitive and surprising. So I don't know if we should be surprised that some legislation is eventually passed. I mean, that should have more or less been the baseline assumption, I think. To which we would also add that part of the issue in the past with other attempts to repeal Obamacare, or the actual Affordable Care Act, sometimes called Obamacare, has been that the constituents of a lot of the folks who are in leadership in the House and Senate will be disproportionately negatively affected. So this is actually a case study in being hostile to government services while also being dependent on them. And the other thing we haven't heard a lot about is that employment related to the Affordable Care Act and to medical jobs in lots of regions, particularly the red states, has been a large source of community success. So not just the obvious provision of health care, which is hugely important, but also really massive amounts of federal and state investment in the community and jobs. And so I think there's become a fear that a lot of folks who had voted in past attempts to repeal, at least in name, knowing that they would not go through, you know, under President Obama, the Affordable Care Act, are now a little bit nervous about having to live within their communities in the, if they do actually repeal the legislation they may have run on repealing. And this might be a great, great case study in sometimes the rhetoric doesn't match the underlying economic reality.
Right. And the who knows, too, we'll see if they're actually going to reduce the tax bracket for the wealthiest down to 35%. Apparently, the New York Times is reporting that Trump is now considering keeping the tax bracket for the wealthiest Americans, you know, pretty much where it is. But just finally, we have to wrap it up, Max. I was really quite struck. Bloomberg has an article about the world's biggest wealth fund hits $1 trillion. Of course, this is Norway. And it's really ironic because they've got healthcare in Norway. They've got an amazing education system in Norway, you know, healthcare as a right in Norway. I mean, all of the things that in the United States, they would say, well, that's socialism. What Norway doesn't have is they're not passing a budget for $700 billion in defense, right? So, you know, because when you look at human needs, we're always told, well, the funds just isn't there. But I think that that thing in Norway, and they're, by the way, having trouble finding where to invest this $1 trillion, you know, revenue that they have coming in.
Yeah, so the Norges Bank, which is the sovereign wealth fund largest in the world, which is sort of the Norway common fund, is also interesting for another reason. So it was started in 1996, and the idea was that the oil wealth that the country, already wealthy before the oil was discovered, should be both was recognized as unsustainable environmentally, and just there's a finite amount of oil. And the idea was to collectivize the benefit of that natural resource by putting it basically into a trust for the future of Norway. And the Norges Bank is, in fact, a government-run trust that takes the revenue from selling that oil, and to your point, invests that revenue, and looks to use that revenue for posterity to support Norway, particularly to support Norway when the economy is bad, and it was tapped for the first time a few years ago to allow social welfare payments to stay up in a weak economy, but also to build on a future when the oil will run out and make sure that future generations don't lose from the all the revenue being consumed by previous generations as we cut taxes and increase spending, probably yet again. That's Norway has reached the $1 trillion mark, doing the opposite of what our budget now seeks to do to our children and their children.
Right. Well, Max Wolf, I'm sorry really to have to leave it there. And we hope that you'll be able to join us yet again soon. We appreciate your work and thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Always a pleasure.